Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday, 26th August, 1980. Venerable sirs and friends, three elements constitute the Brahmacharya: the living of the holy life, the walking in Brahma and to Brahma. And Brahma here means the Upanishadic Brahman, not Brahma, the creator god, or any other figure. Brahma. Do not get afraid of the use of the word Brahma. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the fifth volume, there is this. The Buddha says, it is possible, Ananda, to lay down in this Dhamma discipline a procedure towards Brahma. This, Ananda, is a synonym for the Aryan Eightfold Way. A most significant statement to make. A procedure towards Brahma, also procedure towards Dharma, also the matchless victory in the struggle. And in the Itivuttaka, he says, I, monks, am a Brahman, one to ask a favor from, ever pure-handed, bearer of my last body, matchless physician and surgeon. You are my own true sons, born of my mouth, born of Dhamma, formed by Dhamma, heirs to Dhamma, not heirs of material things. Note that the Buddha says, you are my true sons, born of my mouth. And in the Rig Veda there is a hymn which says that the Brahmins are born out of the mouth of Brahma. And the definition of Brahman in the Vajrasuchi Upanishads states outright that it has nothing to do with caste or whoever you are by birth, but if you have realized Brahman, that is, gone to the end of the road, then you are a Brahman. It's very significant. So let us not be afraid of the use of the word Brahma. And the Buddha says of himself that he is Brahma become, Dhamma become. I am the life, the way, the truth. Now the three elements are sila, composing the Brahmacharya, are sila, samadhi and panya. Sila, of course, represents the moralities, the straightforward moralities. First, harmlessness. And the use of the word harmlessness perhaps presents the first morality in its most inclusive and its widest form. To say thou shalt not murder puts it in its very dramatic form. But harmlessness, and it must be distinctly understood that it is harmlessness not only in act but also in thought and in speech. In the Shandilya Upanishad, you will find it repeated that for the yogi, that is to say, he who would tread the path to the end, in thought and speech and action, the yamas, the moralities, are to be observed. And harmlessness is one of them. The next, as you know, is to take only what is given to you, not to take what is not given. And I should like to put it this way: take what is freely given. In our world, sometimes things are grudgingly given. Maybe your salary is grudgingly paid. Well, don't take it. The third sila is to refrain from self-indulgence in all sensuous experience. I say sensuous rather than confine it to sensual, because that usually is associated exclusively with sexuality. But if you say sensuous experience, it means that everything that comes to you through sight, hearing, taste, touch and smell. Now this comprises the entire five sense field of the body. And in addition, there is the sense field of the ordinary mental processes, such as indulging in daydreams and all that sort of thing, the purely mental processes, and in all sorts of feelings. We have to use every sense rightly and fully, and let the senses and the use of the senses become purified. But to indulge in them is not going to help us on the path. The fourth is to abstain from all speech which is lying, slanderous, and so on. To abstain harsh speech which makes producing quarrels and arguments, unnecessary arguments, and so on. Abstain from all that. The Buddha says of himself in the Brahmajala Sutta, which is a very important long discourse and worthy of the most careful study. He says of himself that he himself is one who speaks the truth, who uses gentle speech, speech which promotes peace and harmony between people. So we must bear that in mind when we talk. Then the fifth one is to refrain from all intoxicants, all stimulants which are really harmful, especially insofar as they desensitize the body, the whole psychophysical organism, to finer influences and all the subtle forces which play their part in our daily life, and of which usually we are quite unconscious. It desensitizes the body, and of course we all know that drinking and so forth can affect the brain. So that is not exactly something which will promote treading the path. So we have to refrain from that. Then of course there are many other advices, as they are called. They are not called commandments in Buddhism nor in Hinduism. They are advices. If you are concerned with treading the path, with living the holy life and arriving at your true final human fulfillment, then it is better to go this way than to go the other way. So those are the silas. Then we come to the next point, samadhi. Now, because we talk in terms of the next point or the next step, please don't think that they follow one another. They all go together. The whole of life functions in a most wonderful togetherness. Doesn't function in little bits. Consider your own body, for instance. Your liver doesn't function from 6 to 8 and your heart from 8 to 10 and your brain from 10 to 12, or is it 10 to 10, 5 past 10, as the case may be. You see, the whole thing, it functions as a whole. That is the nature of life, right down to the physical body itself. And it is the nature of the life of the entire universe to function as a whole, as a totality. And if we become increasingly sensitive to that, then we finally can realize complete at-one-ment with this total reality, with transcendence itself. Now, in connection with the word samadhi, it is usually translated as meditation. It's not a good translation. If you look in the dictionary, meditation is defined as musing or thinking or pondering over some subject or other, very often a religious subject. Now, that is partially true. But samadhi, the word samadhi itself, represents the supreme meditative state. What in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, in the first chapter, is called the asampranyata samadhi. You'll have to sort of study this by yourself to appreciate what is the meaning of this asampranyata samadhi. It is the yogic equivalent of the supreme state meditative point which is reached in the Buddhist meditative system through the jhanas and the samadhis, samapattis, and the final cessation as such. In the Upanishads, you have four stages mentioned. Then they are called avasthas, not jhanas and samapattis, but they are called avasthas. And they are divided into four parts. But the fourth part is the supreme transcendent state itself, corresponding to the asampranyata samadhi of the yogi and the cessation as taught by the Buddha. So, samadhi actually means that supreme meditative state. That's what it actually means. That state of meditation is a state of complete oneness with the creative activity of the primordial creative power in the universe, which functions in eternity. It's beyond both time and timelessness. If we have a few minutes, I'll say something about eternity and time and timelessness. And it functions naturally and spontaneously. You don't have to work at it in order to do it. Entering that state, it remains with you naturally and spontaneously. It cannot be produced or led up to. It is there. It supervenes when there is the total purification of the whole individual, psychically and physically. It does not emerge out of thought, definitely. It does not emerge out of thought. The chitta vritti, that is to say, the fluctuations of your consciousness, of your state of awareness, and the chitta vritti are naturally absent where there is samadhi. They are naturally absent. You don't have to suppress them. This is one of the mistakes made when scholars translate the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and the first statement, yoga chitta vritti nirodha. They say yoga is the suppression of the transformations of thought. It isn't suppression at all. It has nothing to do with suppression. It has to do with a release out of the state of fluctuation and arriving to into emerging into a state of complete communion, which is peaceful. There is no suppression involved there. It is utterly joyful. It is blissful. Samadhi cannot be taught by anyone to anyone else, any more than anyone else can teach you to be alive. You live by virtue of life. No one can teach you all your natural functions. Digestion, heartbeat, blood flow, etc. They go on naturally, in the quiet. So too, when you realize the silence and stillness into which you enter through your own effort, the meditative state, the unbroken communion, supervenes. It just comes into being. It is there at last. It is there all the time around us, in us, through us, but we are unawake to it. We must realize that. So it is not any sort of technical process by the psychophysical organism which enables you to realize the full samadhi. Samadhi is a living functioning of pure mind. I think it was yesterday we talked about mind and psyche. Mind is this universal archetypal energy which releases cosmos in the process of the activity of the primordial creative energy in eternity. And samadhi is the living functioning of that pure mind working through your empty, transparent psyche, purified by the practice of samasati and the silas. The silas are absolutely indispensable in each and every sphere of our life. Whether we want to live the religious life or not, it doesn't matter. If we are going to be decent human beings in the world, then the silas are the absolute foundation. There can be no compromise or fooling about with them. And samasati is one of the aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path. Here again, the Eightfold Path is not trod in eight different compartments. They are all together, right from the beginning, from samadhi through samasankapo, samma vacha, samma kamanto, samma ajivo, samma sati, and samma samadhi. Technically, the samma sati is of the supreme importance. That is the thing that has to be carried out constantly. Samma sati, perfect mindfulness. Samadhi can also be looked at, seen as the supreme togetherness of the one total reality. This is the re legere, the gathering together, the supreme togetherness, the perfect communion. It is in the context of non-finitude. Its context is infinite, immeasurable. It is beyond time and timelessness. Now, beyond time you can appreciate at once. People regard eternity as the opposite of time. It is nothing of the sort. Time is the rhythm of the living process of the universe. Your body marks time through your heartbeat, your pulse, and so on. Your body marks time there. And the rhythm, any rhythm, take music or whatever you like, rhythm is not an absolutely mechanical, undeviating tick-tock. It moves in curves, if you like, beautiful, graceful curves all the time. So time in its reality is a rhythm of the living process of the universe. Now, we do experience timelessness when our attention is completely absorbed by something. Our attentiveness has reached that pitch where we are no longer aware of the passage of time. And that is the experience of timelessness. But timelessness is not eternity, because the experiencing of timelessness has a beginning, and that beginning is in time. Midday, Wednesday, or whatever it is. And then ultimately one has to emerge out of that timeless condition, because the needs of the body have to be fulfilled. So you, when you come out of it, your limited experience within a span of time is an experience of timelessness. Eternity subsumes both time and timelessness. I have no words for eternity. But by eliminating that which is not actually eternity itself, one has taken a step nearer to it. And then you can appreciate a statement like this, which I make time and again. The activity of the primordial creative energy in eternity. And there is a very important significance in connection with that, which perhaps we'll talk about tomorrow. Now, I think concentration, perfect concentration, is not a good word at all for samadhi. Concentration, making yourself pay attention to the matter in hand, is a very useful practice, undoubtedly. But that is not samadhi, because when you make the effort as such, then there is a state of conflict, a state of deliberate control being exercised. The element of suppression comes into it, and so forth. Whereas that is, of course, quite helpful in certain ways, especially in our ordinary everyday life. But it is not true meditation. And in the reality of meditation, there is no exclusiveness whatsoever. Meditation is the meditative state is a completely inclusive state, so that the entire universe can talk with you, be with you, and you can respond to it. It's an extraordinary thing. All the senses are pacified, but they are fully active. They are sensitive to the utmost degree, so that the impressions from outside, sounds, sights, etc., they come to you, you receive them, but you do not react for or against them. There is neither attachment nor aversion. And in this, there is the state of purity of the psyche. Also, when one is in that sort of state, then the elimination of so many beliefs, convictions, and mistaken conceptions, they all disappear. You begin to be free of them. And then you realize the true meaning of emptiness, the first and the true meaning. Namely, you become void of ill. Your psyche becomes empty of all ill, all mistakes, in every sphere and in every respect. And that is the state when the psyche is completely pure and transparent. It's transparent so that the light of transcendence can shine through it. If ever you have, even for a few seconds, experienced that state, you'll know what it is like. It is so extraordinary, one can't speak about it. Absolutely a transcendent state. The training in concentration is necessary, yes, of course, is in the worldly context of mortality. It contributes to being released into samadhi, to your being released into the state of samadhi. The sphere of pure mind, the mind which is utter one great unity, there is no separation of conscious mind and unconscious mind and all the marvelous differentiations which clever people like to make. Now, with regard to the group practice of meditation, We call it meditation when we all meet together at a certain time, and we are led into that meditation. But here is something which is a little bit of a thunderbolt from the Buddha. It comes in the Mahasunyata Sutta. It's in volume 3 of the Majjhima Nikaya, and I think it's Sutta number 122. That's right. The Buddha says, a monk in company, whether in his own group or another's group, Sanghanika, cannot realize the happiness of renunciation and aloofness from sense pleasures, detachment from sense pleasures, of calm which is conducive to allaying attachment, aversion and confusion, and of self-awakening to the way. But he can realize this if he dwells alone, remote from groups. This comes in the Mahasunyata Samadhi, in the Mahasunyata Sutta. In a group, the situation does not exist that a monk entering on the freedom of mind that is temporal and pleasing, or not temporal and unshakable, that he will abide in it, or continue to abide in it. But alone, remote from a group, he will abide in it. The Tathagata has fully awakened to this abiding, namely, by not attending to the signs of the phenomenal world, entering upon and abiding in an inward emptiness, as if he were alone even when he is in company. So, we have a very significant statement there. Now, do not let that prevent you from attending the group meditations which are held at the summer schools here. They all have their place. After all, when we are children, we have to start learning We have to start learning like children. We can't do otherwise. So much for samadhi. And panya, insight. Well, insight accompanies all that is involved in the brahmacharya, in the living of the holy life. Insights will come and they will go also. That is to say, they will be replaced by deeper insights. Be very careful. When you get an insight, don't get so elated as to say, oh, now I have got the truth. Again, read the Brahmajala Sutta very carefully, and you will get a good deal of information about that matter. Because when the first insights come, they are at a certain level of awakenedness, inward awakenedness. Those insights, as we progress, naturally give place to profounder insights, until finally there is the complete and full awakening, the Samma Sambodhi, and then you have reached the peak point of all insights, and you have unerring insight then into the truth of whatever comes your way, and into the truth of all things. Unerring insight, remember. This is not intuition. Intuition is a bad word to translate the word buddhi, the Platonic nous. Nous, buddhi, really means unerring insight. I don't know whether Plato would like to agree with me or not, but that's what I think nous is. Really, unerring insight, not intuition. Hitler had his intuitions, and what did he do with them? The devil has his intuitions, and what does he do with them? He plays the devil with all of us. So don't say intuition. Anybody can have what he calls intuition for this, that, or the other. But yes, it's a little bit of an insight, but don't make too much of intuition as such. Don't rely too much upon it. You can be misled by intuitions. Now, yesterday we talked a little bit about the Paticca Samuppada, the 12 elements which compose, which explain the rationale of the uprising of dukkha and the extinction of dukkha by the extinction of each of those 12 elements. And you remember we talked about the impossibility of progressing at all if we took we understood that literally, because if you extinguish nama rupa, your psychophysical organism, well, that's the end of all progress on the path whilst you're alive anyway. Now it starts with avidya. It is useful to try and understand the meaning of avidya. It's translated as ignorance. But it does not mean the ignorance of chemistry or algebra or music or something like that. It means, in the words of Sariputta, who explains it very well, in the Sammadithi Sutta, it's in the first volume of the Majjhima, number 9, I think. Sariputta says, not to know the truth of ill, not to know the cause of ill, not to know the stopping of ill, not to know the way to the stopping of ill. This is what constitutes, fundamentally constitutes avidya, avidya, ignorance. Now, do remember, the first two truths are worldly truths, the fact of ill and the cause of ill. The third and the fourth truths, the affirmation, the positive affirmation of the extinction of ill and the way to it, are transcendental truths. Take the last one, the way. It is called the middle way. There's nothing middle about it, in fact. There is no compromise. It's not a case of having God on this arm and the devil on that arm and being nice to both and you walk in the middle. It isn't that at all. If you look at all the elements of the way, it's sama this, sama the other, and so on. All the eight elements are sama. Sama is usually translated as right in English. But right is a somewhat flabile word in the context. Sama means perfect. And whatever is of the nature of, or could become of the nature of, perfection is not something which is in the middle. It is at the apex, the peak point of whatever is being done. It's the perfect way. And therefore, do not get misled into thinking that you just live moderately. Don't overeat, don't overdrink, don't overspend, and so forth. Not that. It's the perfect thing altogether. No compromise anywhere. That has to be borne in mind. So, Sariputta says, the ignorance of those four truths, the not to know those four truths, is the meaning of avidya. That is the negative expression of the meaning of avidya. There is a positive meaning too. Avidya, or avidya of Pali, is the opposite of vidya. Vidya is translated usually as knowledge. Now, its root is vid. The root vid means to see. To see. To see with the eye of the awakened being, he who has realized samasambodhi. That is the state of vidya, that knowledge, that state of knowledge, which in ordinary theistic theologies particularly, we call the omniscience of God. Vidya is just that, to have the ability to see the whole truth of things with unerring insight. That is vidya, you see. So it's very useful to see, to understand vidya and avidya in that way. It's avidya, then, is the inability to see the truth transcendentally, perfectly, without making any mistake as regards what you're seeing. Now, with regard to preliminary steps which one takes to lead up to the true state, the true meditative state, the full samadhi, with regard to the preliminary states, first put aside all lust, all lustful thoughts, feelings, etc. Next, put aside all malevolence. When I say put aside, you can't push them out like that, throw them out of the window, so to say. You just have to sit and be perfectly calm and quiet and let the psychical turmoil, the psychical dirt, so to say, just quietly settle down and disappear from the scene. Then sloth and torpor, worry and flurry. People get worried, oh, am I making progress? 40 years I've been sitting cross-legged for 3 hours each day and I haven't got any further, I'm just as much confused and so forth. If you worry, you'll become even more confused. So avoid all worry and flurry. The worry is a self-oriented thing, concerned with oneself. Do remember that. That's why we worry. Otherwise we won't worry. Take it easy. And finally, doubt. There is one element of doubt which also can be classed under doubt, which we must not get rid of. And that is to realize the importance of not being gullible, not swallowing things lock, stock and barrel without questioning. Investigate. The Buddha says very definitely in the limbs of enlightenment, he says investigation, constant investigation all the time. You hear something, you read something, you're told something. All right? Is it so? Is it not so? Let us see. Do it in a calm and a quiet way, dispassionately. Now that could be called doubt what is being said. And exercising that kind of doubt, you will find a great deal of purification of the psyche proceeding apace, especially in connection with all the sort of fixed beliefs and ideas and conceptions we have. Practically none of them have any warrant whatsoever where the ultimate truth is concerned. Don't we know from our own living experience, when we were adolescent, especially when we were adolescent, in my case it was right from my childhood, I was conceited enough from the age of 8 or onwards or so to think that, oh yes, I knew all about this and the other, and what I thought was perfectly right. When I reached 20, I scratched my head and said, well, you know, I wasn't quite right in this, that or the other particular. And at 30, I had to discard what I thought at 20. And now at 78, I discard everything, everything. I say, it may be so, it may not be so, I don't know. Leave it alone. You see? That is why I often tell everybody who comes and talks to me or listens to me, don't believe a word of what I say. Examine it. Consider it. Yes, consider it carefully. And remember the meaning of the word consider. It's derived from con, together with, and sidus. Sider is a star. What is a star? A self-shining light. Think of the significance of this. A self-shining light. Now to consider then means to look into a thing in such a manner that you really see the truth of it, because the truth is a self-shining light. So consider everything carefully. Now, as one progresses that way, one goes through the various stages which have been called the jhanas and the samapattis. The jhanas. Jhana, of course, is the Pali form of dhyana, the Sanskrit dhyana, which means a state of attentiveness. A state of attentiveness. In the preliminary state of attentiveness, there is a constant thought process going on, an examination process. Vittakka, vichara is present, together with rapture and happiness and so forth. Now, this thought process is an inaudible talking process. It's only it's discursive thought, as we call it in English, quite rightly, discursive thought. Discursive thought belongs to the realm of speech, essentially to the realm of speech. And it's just talk about the subject which you have, to which you are paying attention. Now, if you remain as quiet as possible, let that talk go on, you will find that it will subside. It will subside, but you will be perfectly conscious. In fact, you will be more intensely conscious. Throughout the jhanas and the samapattis, the consciousness becomes more and more intense. It varies in intensity. It's not like climbing the rungs of a ladder at all. There is no climbing about it. Here, now the whole thing happens. Here in this fathom-long body is the entire universe and the entire universal process. So it happens here. The intensity of that consciousness, that awareness, and the awakenedness which accompanies it becomes greater and greater. Until there comes the point when the sense functions are completely pacified. They are not suppressed, they are not discarded, but they are pacified in a state of perfect peace. And finally, the talking process will stop. The flow of words will stop on its own. Don't try to blank the mind, as some people have written in books on meditation and whatnot. You can't blank the mind. In any case, a good many people's minds are blank to start with. So don't attempt to blank the mind. Just let it happen. Let the storm, the whirlwind subside. It will subside on its own if you just be patient and wait long enough and carry on sensibly enough. And then you enter, as it is put in the text, you enter the second jhana. Now, this second jhana has been designated the Aryan silence. And in this connection, remember how the Buddha said, and you'll find this in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, number 26, in the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya. He was approaching the hall where the monks used to gather together and talk. And he heard voices as he approached, so he knew that they were talking. And then when the voices subsided, he coughed gently to sort of indicate that there's somebody outside, and he tapped the door. Consider the courtesy of the Buddha. The Buddha to do that. It's like God knocking at your door and saying, please, may I come in and see you? It's quite extraordinary. I am always wonder-stricken with the courtesy and the good manners of the Buddha. And if you read the Brahmayu Sutta, you will find a good description of the good manners of the Buddha. And they are peculiarly like Victorian good manners in England. Quite a good bit of the description there is like that. So I have no disparagement for Victorian good manners. You may call it hypocrisy if you like, and sometimes probably it was hypocrisy. But what led up to it? How did it come into being at all? There must have been something very wonderful about it all. And he went in and he asked what were you discussing? What were you talking about? And he was told that they were talking about sense delights, reverence, honor, etc., being obtained by becoming monks. So, and about the chief craft and other such trivial matters. So the Buddha said, monks, it is not seemly for you to talk such talk. When you sit down together in conclave, one of two things is to be done. Either talk in accordance with Dhamma or observe the Aryan silence, the noble silence. Now the, what is the Aryan silence? Ariyo Tunhi Bhavo, as it is called. And it Moggallana on one occasion says to the monks, when a monk by pacifying initial and discursive thought, his mind subjectively tranquilized and fixed on one point, enters into and abides in the second jhana, which is devoid of initial and discursive thought, that is all the talk has stopped, is born of concentration, full of zest and ease, then this is what we call the Aryan silence. Now in that silence, you are perfectly conscious, remember, but you have stopped talking. You have stopped all the inaudible talk. Now what is the tremendous significance of this ending of the talk? It is what I call the passage through the first portal of death. When talking has ceased in the mind, what actually has ceased to afflict the awakened state of consciousness? Every word represents an object or thing. It represents an activity, action, circumstance, this, that, or the other. In short, it represents the entire turmoil of the world process, and that turmoil in one's, and the turmoil in one's own being. And it is this which belongs to the realm of mortality, all this turmoil through the senses and so forth. Now, when that has stopped, in what manner are you conscious? This is the first death, so to say. And you enter into the life which is the true life as such. You come to life only then. So you are conscious now, one step at least nearer the consciousness of immortality and not of mortality. All that happens in the world and all that happens through the senses belongs to mortality, because it comes into being, it enters your consciousness, it goes through some process perhaps, and then it dies, it passes away. So everything is mortal which has to do with the talking process and with the sense process as such, and our reactions to the senses. Especially our attachments and aversions, which are the root of craving and violence. So now, you enter that state for the first. You get the first taste of the meaning of immortality. The first sort of inkling of what eternity can mean. Can mean, because you will still be in the timeless state, which is not actually synonymous with eternity, as I tried to suggest. So that is the importance, one great important point in connection with this Aryan silence, that in that silence you have taken the first great step forward through the portal of death. Remember that each state of consciousness which is deeper and more intense implies the death of the previous state. There is no such thing as growth without change. It has to change, and change implies the death of what was there before, the moment or the hour before. That has to die in order that the new may emerge out of what is dying. because you, the person as such, are still there and alive. You see? So this is the importance to, which we must attach to the Aryan silence. And in that state, one's insights become deeper and profounder and nearer the appreciation and evaluation of the truth of things.